So let's get to the point. We have our very distinguished guests that you will be able to hear a bit later, who are Regina Rossmann, Senior Associate at Convergence Blended Finance, Marie-Aimée Bourri, Head of Impact-Based Finance at Société Générale CIB, and Jyoti Banerjee, Co-Founder of North Star Transition. They will introduce themselves a bit later on. Myself, I'm Raphaël Hara, Managing Director of XAPA. XAPA is a mission-driven company, and our purpose is really to act as a catalyzer to help transform the economy towards economically, socially, and environmentally sound economic models. We propose a different kind of services related to sustainability consulting, especially on business and human rights, sustainable finance, impact investing, and responsible sourcing. And we gather a different kind of expertise and networks all over the world, driving a community of experts and affiliates, as well as global and local partners to help implement the programs and missions that we perform for our clients. We are also very involved in advocacy activities and propose to and release lots of open source content on our website, xapa.org, that you can use to get information on social and environmental topics in economic activities. Especially, we work on and have developed a solution called SWTI, Scale-Up Training Traceability Impact. It's an initiative that helps transform the first mile of agricultural supply chains, working with and for smallholders, with different stakeholders, public and private. We have developed different programs in Asia, for example, in Indonesia and Sri Lanka, and soon in Africa, with impact investors, development institutions, governments, both OECD and local governments, corporates, local industrial companies, NGOs, and experts. And the idea is really to bridge the gap and reach the scale to help this transformation of this first mile of agricultural supply chains. So we do that by designing a solution including three modules: technical assistance, meaning program design and management, low-tech digital solutions that we have developed in-house that enable to go to scale at an affordable cost, with solutions that work on every mobile phone, not only smartphones, that work offline and that work for also for illiterate persons. The idea is really to disseminate best practices and diversify farmer activities, because almost 90% of the smallholder farmers owning or operating farms of less than 2 hectares, who are more than 500 million in the world, do not have access to capacity building and training, which is a powerful lever for value creation for them. And the idea is really to structurally improve the revenue of the smallholders, their livelihoods, and to strengthen the agricultural supply chains of commodities from that point of view. We also include in our services access to innovative impacting finance, and that's the topic of today. These digital and financial levers enable us to target three kinds of impacts in a multidimensional approach: economic, with increased and revenues and diversification of activities; social, with access to education and digital technologies, as well as social inclusion, including gender and youth action; and environmental, with impact on carbon sequestration and biodiversity protection. So let's get to the topic today. We know that agriculture is part of the problem and of the solution at the same time of our need for environmental and social transition. The demand for food will increase by 70% by 2050, according to the World Bank. And regenerative agriculture is a nature-based solution, which is more and more recognized as a necessary target, not only for large plantations, or large operating companies, but also for smallholders. We know that the FoLu sector, agriculture, forestry, and other land use, is the signification of the FoLu acronym, represent almost 20% of the total GHG emissions. And that the soil health can stock, the action on soil health can stock huge amounts of carbon and be a shelter to biodiversity. So the potential is of 15 to 1600 of million of hectare of cropland, meaning almost 12% of the global land, with a potential of around 0.6 ton per year through improved carbon soil management. The global potential is huge. In the same time, it's unavoidable to take care about soil health, to store water during droughts, and also to avoid large flooding catastrophes. Considering the social dimensions, as mentioned earlier, only about 10% of the smallholders, of the 500 million smallholders, have access to capacity building, and almost 2 billion persons directly depend on these farms, which represent about 25% of the of mankind. So smallholders play a critical role in agricultural supply chain and face multiple challenges. They are like 60% and 70% of respectively South Asia and Africa's populations directly derive their livelihood from agriculture. 60% of the world's poor work in agriculture, and more than 85% of smallholders have no access to capacity building. So this rises to 95% in countries like India. And lastly, agriculture is 25% of the GDP and more than 60% of the workforce in the low-income countries. So the social stakes are totally huge from that point of view. In terms of funding gap, we know that the pre-COVID funding gap were estimated to 2.5 to 5 trillion per year to reach the SDGs. And we know that also on transition of agriculture in developing countries, less than half of what was needed to get this on road was invested in 2019, so let alone in the post-COVID context. During the COP27, we have also learned that only 3% of the climate financing go to agriculture, which is almost 20 times less than for renewable energy. And lastly, by 20, the Climate Policy Initiative estimated that we have to increase by 25-fold the financing to agriculture by 2030 to be able to reach the SDGs. So how to channel funding towards regenerative and fair transition of agriculture? What are the solutions that work? Is it support to innovation? Is it nature-based solutions? Is it VCMs, externalities valuation, payment for ecosystem services, support farmers, microfinance, de-risking, public-private partnerships, outcome-based financing, you name it. That's what we're going to see with our very distinguished guests, and starting with Regina Rossman from Convergent Blended Finance. So hello and welcome, Regina. We'll be hearing from you with great pleasure. Thank you.
Been an increasing focus of blended finance transactions. So renewable energy, of course, still kind of beaten. And that's what Raphael also said himself. But at least there is the trend, right, that shows that over time, you would see more money flowing towards the agriculture sector. So I think that's promising. Now, if we go to the next slide, you'll see that within climate change, when you look at adaptation, that's when you see a lot of the blended finance money going towards agriculture. No matter whether it's agricultural inputs or agro-processing or agroforestry, there is a lot that flows into those subsectors. But overall, of course, if you look at climate finance, most of the money still flows towards mitigation, right? So even if adaptation mostly consists on agriculture, it doesn't mean that a lot of money is actually flowing towards that direction. So I think overall, the ambition that we should all keep in mind is still that we want to mobilize more of the climate finance money into the adaptation sector, which would benefit the agricultural sector a lot. Now, I would want to spend some more time on the archetypes, but if you do have questions on the report, I would just encourage you to go to our website and read it at your own pace, because there's a lot of information and a lot of examples as well in the report.
Yes, thank you, Regina. So my second question is, what are the lessons learned to accelerate the rhythm and scale of investments? In particular, in your opinion, can you present one, two, three examples of innovative instruments and of the principle that you think are the most interesting in terms of blended finance use? Is it de-risking? Is it incentive? Is this guarantee instruments? What are your views on that?
Thanks, Raphael. With that, let's go to the next slide, because I've actually brought to you the most common types of blended finance, and I don't think we'll have time to go over all of them. But I think guarantees and risk sharing mechanisms, so the third column that you see here, is really key, because a lot of times the problem that smallholder farmers face is that they simply can't provide the collateral that the commercial bank would need in order to be eligible for a loan. And so there is a lot of mechanisms out there that try to overcome that barrier. And so the PASS Trust, the private agriculture support program in Tanzania, is one example, whereby this program provides a credit guarantee cover to the local commercial banks to top up clients' collateral so that they become eligible for loans. So this guarantee ratio is about 50 to 75%, which is quite high. And with that offer, this program has been able to work with 15 commercial banks in Tanzania. And so what that does, basically, this mechanism allows the banks to do business with farmers that they normally would not even consider eligible. And so that can be a real game changer. And the ambition, of course, of these guarantee and risk sharing mechanisms is that over time, the bank realizes that these farmers aren't as risky as they perceived them to be. And so even when you then take away and phase out the guarantee mechanism, the idea is that hopefully the banks would still continue on lending to the same group of farmers, because they have now learned that a lot of them actually are able to repay their loans. So that's why I think guarantees and risk sharing mechanisms are really important in the agricultural sector to overcome that barrier in particular. Another example that I would look at is the very right column on this slide, concessional debt or equity inserted within the capital structure. So if you look at the blended finance transactions in agriculture, a lot of them channel money directly into agribusinesses. So the blending is within the agribusiness company structure. But we at Convergence actually are a believer in aggregated fund structures. So we would want the money to be pooled into a vehicle that then disperses smaller amounts to the individual agribusinesses. And by pooling different types of capital in that fund structure, concessional debt or concessional equity, you can actually provide a risk cushion to the investors in the senior tranches, and you can get investors that normally would not consider agriculture as a viable sector to come in while maintaining their risk return profile. So they don't need to suddenly take on more risk. They simply just come alongside the concession and capital providers, and thereby are able to contribute to the sustainable development goal. Examples include the Incofin Fair Trade Access Fund or Inter-Resilience Investment Fund here. There's many more, but these are just two examples that I wanted to pick. For more content on that, I would recommend that you take a look at the Smallholder and Agri SME Finance and Investment Network, SAFIN. If you haven't come across them, they have excellent resources on blended finance. I will post it in the chat here. And they have actually put together a resources page with a lot of case studies of different blended finance mechanisms. And we find them really valuable at Convergence.
Thank you very much, Regina. So sorry about the little technical problems we are facing. So while Marie-Aimée will present herself and her activities at Société Générale, I will try to fix that. So sorry about that. So Marie-Aimée, hello. Nice to have you on board. And can you please present your departments and activities at Société Générale?
Sure. So I'm Marie-Aimée Bourri. I'm head of impact-based finance, which is a small team that sits in the investment banking division of the bank. What we're trying to be is a catalyst to open new markets for the bank, targeting specifically markets where we see a high positive impact and a high scale-up potential, but where currently the bank does not have on-the-shelf solutions to fund those projects or companies. So we work with all the group. We don't push a specific product. And typically, we focus on those impact value chains that we believe have the most potential for uncovering sustainable business models. So these are access to energy in developing countries, energy efficiency in developed countries, circular economy business models, and natural capital, in which we include sustainable and regenerative agriculture.
Thank you, Marie-Aimée. Concretely, how is Société Générale supporting the transition of commodity supply chains to a fair and sustainable agriculture? What are, in particular, the innovations that you bring, the achievements that you have reached in this space of agricultural transition?
Sure. So before we give I give examples of specific financing products, I think it's important to remember that for any client that we are banking, we are going to apply our sectoral policies. So the bank has a strong commitment for environmental and social impact. And so we have set some specific policies. In particular, there is one specifically on agriculture and the biodiversity. And so we engage with our clients to make sure that they comply with our policies and including, for example, clients that are active in sensitive sectors that could generate, for example, a deforestation. So we engage with them and we're trying to see how we can support them into taking the actions needed so that they comply with our policies. Then if we speak about products and the financing solutions, so first, there is a category of what I would call the medium size or large clients that on which we can easily lend to based on their financials. So here, what we're trying to do is engage with them to see how they can embed in their financing some specific incentives or objectives. So here I'm thinking about the sustainability linked loans that are a way to integrate into a financing the objectives, the strategic objectives that a company might have set for themselves. And if we take concrete examples in the space of, in the area, sorry, of sustainable agriculture, recently we've arranged a financing for SUGDEN, a soft commodity trader, whereby we could set some KPIs that are linked to fighting against child labor, distributing shade tree seeds, and reducing water consumptions. All three KPIs covering SUGDEN's main activities in their three main regions. So cocoa in Africa, coffee in Asia, and sugar in Europe. Another example is a recent sustainability link loan that we've done for Bell. So here we're in Europe, and we're looking at the initiatives that were taken by this group in order to reduce the greenhouse gas emission from their supply chain. So support their suppliers in performing a carbon diagnosis for the dairy farms, and also providing nutritious food to their end customers. And maybe one last example of sustainability in finance is a bit older deal, but interesting because it was the first ever in Africa, which is a loan for Ghana Cocoa Board, where again, they've chosen some KPIs that are significant for their activity in relation to promoting environmentally friendly cocoa production, increasing sensitivity to child labor and empowering women. So that's for the sustainability linked labeled transactions. But of course, as part of our business with companies active in agriculture, we're trying to support them when they have some programs that have positive impact. So for example, making loans that allow them to improve their practices. So we have this example of natural rubber production in Africa, in Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana, where we've lent them money and it allowed them to commit to reduce deforestation. And we're also looking at helping smaller companies, and maybe in a different way. So for example, helping startups to identify equity partners. So here I've got the example of a Send to Green, which is a French startup that uses off-grid desalination units in order to plant trees in desertic areas, fruit-bearing trees. And so they have a sustainable business model where the revenues from the fruit production and the carbon credits enable the repayment of the initial capex.
Thanks a lot, Marie-Aimée. Among all that, and even in your plan, what are the most promising paths and instruments that you have identified to activate, but also mainstream, the agricultural transition? Have you maybe a few examples to share with us?
Sure. So as you were saying, a lot of the support needs to be taken at the first mile level, and unfortunately does not necessarily fit with our customer base. So our objective is always to find who are the aggregators, and I'm clearly in line with what Regina just said. It's often easier for lending purposes to have portfolios, aggregate portfolios of loans. It provides more diversification. So those aggregators can be cooperatives, for example. So looking at how we can provide additional financing or dedicated financing to cooperatives so that they can then on-lend to farmers, and or simply supporting SMEs active in the agri space, in particular in Africa. So concretely, in Africa, well, two-thirds of our clients, of our corporate clients, are SMEs. So we have opened what we call SME houses in 9 countries. So we're present in 19 countries in Africa. And in 9 of them, we opened these SME houses that are not only for our clients, but any company, especially in the informal sector, to help them build their cash flow models and understand what is necessary to be able to receive financing. Another thing we've been doing already is using blended finance facilities, such as the ones that were suggested by Regina, to be able to lend to SMEs that we would otherwise not been lending to. And then we've also looked at how we can originate lending differently. And one example of that is the partnership we've started with you guys at SUTI. So looking at how we can support the financing of investments needed for the improvement of the practices of smallholder farmers in Africa. So we have this first collaboration starting in the cocoa value chain in West Africa, and we hope we'll be able to find solutions there. Also to be involved is maybe last one thing is a natural capital solution. So we've also built an expertise to propose a natural capital funding solutions to our corporate clients who are looking to improve the quality of their supply chain, whether for insetting or for offsetting. And so we help them select and screen nature-based solution projects so as to maximize the impacts both for the carbon sequestration, of course, but also to have positive impact on biodiversity and on local communities.
Thank you, Marie-Mé. Fascinating. Thanks a lot. Now I turn to Jyoti. Hi, Jyoti. Jyoti Banerjee from NorthStar Transition that he has co-founded. Jyoti, in a few words, can you tell us what you are doing at NorthStar? In fact, we are not an agricultural specialist, but we have invited you because you have passionate work in two fields of landscape approach and also regenerative investment. So can you tell us a bit more, and then we will maybe get a bit more into details.
Super. Well, Rafael, thank you very much for the invitation to take part in this meeting alongside Marie-Mé and Regina. NorthStar Transition was really started with one idea in play, which is we know how much is going wrong around the world. We have fantastic details that have been given to us by scientists and climatologists and so on. And yet, is this the best we can do? Because everywhere we are looking, we seem to be getting into a worse place. And so my co-founder, Olivier Boutelis, who's based in Brussels, and myself, based just outside London, our question was, is there another way we can tackle these problems? And our simplistic, but possibly naive diagnosis was that every time we were faced with one of the big crises we're facing, whether it's climate or biodiversity or soil health or water or inequalities, whatever the crisis, the way to solve that crisis was often viewed from one particular perspective, one particular silo. And the solution for that crisis, let's say, for example, net zero to address the carbon problem, often disregarded all the other crises. It's almost as if the other crises didn't exist. And our question was, is there another way we can do this? Because clearly we have to tackle these things together. So NorthStar Transition started what we call a transition lab, where we set up a process for the nation of Wales. So this isn't Wales as in the mammals in the sea, but this is Wales as in the nation, the small nation that's part of the United Kingdom. And remember, we were in the midst of a global pandemic, so we couldn't actually go anywhere. So we had to start in a place that we could easily access the change that we wanted to see. And what we did was we asked the question, what would Wales look like if it could be regenerative? We know today it's degenerative, not because I have anything against Wales, but because I know every single place we live on planet Earth, where we have got involved with our business systems and our finance systems and our agricultural practices, et cetera, they're degenerative places. So we asked the question, what would a regenerative Wales look like? And to answer that question, we brought together leaders from across different sectors. So we wanted food and farming in the room. We wanted health. We wanted environment and nature, finance, business, insurance, local government, etc. So we've now got about 40 of these sorts of leading organizations collaborating together. And they came up with a number of ambitions for what they wanted to see in Wales. So these are ambitions that not any single one of these organizations can deliver on their own, or even all 40 of them together can't do it. We'd need the entire nation to shift. And so if you can see the slides, there are four ambitions that have been laid out. And in case you think your screen has gone funny and you can't read what's on the slides, it's because there are Welsh words that have been put in there, because these are Welsh people, you know, wanting to express what they want to see happen. And I'll give you a couple of examples of this. So at one level, they'd like to see their air, soil, and water healthy for future generations. And to put it in context, only 7% of Welsh waterways are healthy today. So how do you go from 7% to 100%? They also want to know, can they have a food system that's optimized for the well-being of the communities that consume that food, rather than what it is today, which is optimized for maximizing yield, regardless of the well-being of the people who eat it, regardless of the environmental impacts. So when you start putting these sort of ambitions together, you realize, wow, we have a huge task ahead of us. And if you just move one slide, what we found was that there are significant challenges to enabling the sort of idea that we're talking about, which is, can we actually have the air, soil, and water healthy in, for future generations? So in order to test our thinking, we put together a program to say, let's take one landscape, which is Southeast Wales. It has two main rivers, the Wye and the Usk rivers, really, you know, much loved rivers, deeply, deeply polluted rivers. And we said, what would it take to transform them? And what we discovered is that to transform those rivers, to make them healthy again, we're going to need something like 1,800 farmers to change their business practices so that they're not getting the runoff from their soils into the rivers. We're going to need the water company to stop putting sewage straight into the rivers, which even in the UK still continues to happen. We're going to need the farms that produce chickens for companies like Cargill to stop allowing the poo from the chicken, to use a polite word, to use the poo from the chickens to end up in the rivers. We're going to have to see all kinds of change happen. So in order to get a landscape healthy, we need to see all those actions taken. And the problem is, as Marie-Aimé and Regina have been talking about, you know, the actions that need to happen on the ground that will be transformative are tiny. And nobody gets interested in that from finance. So we are going through the process of working out, how do you aggregate the actions together? How do you create the right environment by which the actions can result in outcomes? And we have calculated that in broad terms, we need about £1 billion. These days, £1 billion is pretty much $1 billion in terms of the volume of finance needed to enable the actions that would take place on the ground.
Yes, and Jyoti, maybe just one question before we move on to the next topic. But you know, with our SUTI initiative, we work in Sri Lanka, in Indonesia, for example, and soon, hopefully, with the help of Société Générale in West Africa, on samples of several thousand of smallholders. So my question is, how it's super important to go out of silos thinking. That's for sure, and that's why I think your initiative is superb. But how can you embark all of these specific wheels business units in a global transition? Is it through incentivization? Is it through payment for externalities? What are the tricks that you have designed for the moment?
Well, it's really interesting to see that when you have a discussion about food and farming, the people who are often left out of that discussion are health. But in Wales, they spend £500 million a year on diabetes. And yet, the people who are involved in spending that money, the health system, have zero agency, zero visibility, probably zero interest in the decisions that are happening regarding, you know, what food is being grown, where it's being grown, how it is processed, the lifestyle of the people who eat that food, et cetera, et cetera. So you end up with a diabetes bill that continues to rise every single year, while we're completely ignoring the fact that we also have to see a transformation on the food side. So by bringing health and finance and food and the environment all into the same place, we are seeing new opportunities for change. So for example, the health people said initially, we have nothing to do with food. And then they discovered not just the diabetes thing, but they actually buy £22 million worth of food every single year just to feed hospital patients. And we asked them, where does that food come from? And it turns out they buy the cheapest food that they possibly can buy because they want to spend their money on hip replacements or, you know, global pandemic, whatever, but they're not going to spend it on the food. But as a result, they're buying food that is the cheapest food, it's grown badly, it has deep environmental impacts. And actually, they don't even buy the food from Wales, they buy the food from elsewhere. And so they're not even helping the local communities. And so we have helped them think through how they can use their 22 million, which seems like a small sum of money, but if they can use it smarter ways, that is a transformational opportunity. Actually, Welsh government has looked at what we're doing with the health sector and said, but the same challenges also apply to the procurement of food for schools, for prisons, for social care. And if we can put all of that together, now we're suddenly at £130 million spend that happens every year. And if we can redirect that money already, we can make sure that money that is being spent already, we're not having to go find new money for that. It's existing money that just needs to be spent smarter. Mm-hmm. So by bringing the different sectors together, we can think through the opportunities in a way that perhaps might be harder if we're just trying to push on one door. So that's why we're really keen to see multiple sectors, multiple disciplines being brought together.
Thank you, Jyoti. So you are also part of a very passionate initiative to which I have the pleasure to participate regularly, which is called
and Marie-Aimée the Regenerative, as well.
And Marie-Aimée as well. Yeah. It's the Regenerative Investment Lab. So can you tell us briefly, because we need to leave some space for a dialogue on the very passionate themes we have to plan to share. What is the Regenerative Investment Lab?
Well, thank you for asking about the Regen Investment Lab, because my basic question is this. We know the rules of today's business system. It's basically, can we make as much money as possible for our investors? Can we externalize whatever costs possible so that we make as much money for our investors? And by the way, ideally, we want to externalize our costs as far as possible to the people who can do least to fight against us so that we don't have to, you know, get into any awkward battles over why we are passing the costs on to them. So if they are poor workers in Southeast Asia and we're a textile company, we want them to bear the costs. We're not going to do it. That's how our system works today. And I call that a degenerative system. And I want to ask the question, what are the rules for a regenerative system? It's all very well for us to say we want a regenerative system, but what would the rules for that system look like? How would that system work? And how do we begin to get that kind of system started? Because we need to create a credible alternative to today's system. Today's system is a very credible system in many, many places. So no one's wanting an alternative. Well, let's explore what that alternative could look like. And so the Regen Investment Lab brings together financial institutions, businesses, large corporates from around the world, academics, third sector organizations, and influencers. And basically, we want to ask three questions. One, do we really understand the crises that we face because we live in a degenerative system? So that's the first thing. Secondly, what would the rules of a regenerative system look like? And we think there are, you know, six different areas we're going to have to explore, including things like what would strategy look like? What does good performance look like in a regenerative system? How will governance work? And so on and so forth. And then the third thing is, we don't want an exercise where we write a report that nobody reads. We want this to be real, which is why we love talking to folks like yourself, because you're doing real stuff. And we want to bring the kind of thinking of what needs to happen on the ground, but connect it to the ideas as to how will we make our business systems work in future? So that's where we're going with the Regen Investment Lab, and we're very welcoming of people coming and joining us in this work.
Thank you. Now I would like to engage in a panel discussion with you three, and maybe starting with Regina. You know that we know that you work on a number of topics, and you see lots of things happening in the blended finance space. So my first question would be, how can we collectively ensure that the transition towards this regenerative agriculture, sustainable agriculture, is not only efficient in terms of environmental transition, but also is fair and inclusive for smallholder farmers in particular?
Yeah, I think that's a very relevant question. So a lot of times the problem with smallholder farmers from a blended finance perspective is that the individual investment needs that they have are too small for some of the big investment sums that these private investors need to place, right? So if you really want to bring more money into regenerative agriculture to those smallholder farmers, there is a big need for intermediation. So for somebody to be able to accept the big sums that some of these private investors can give, and then, but also divide it up into small pieces of money that can be given to the smallholder farmers on terms that these farmers can accept, right? Which is a big ask, but it's not impossible. And so through some of the structures that are blended, like blended funds, for example, or facilities, there is ways to channel more of that money to smallholder farmers. But it's not the most straightforward way, and it's a little bit more cumbersome than some of the things that traditional asset managers are used to at the moment. So I think there's a big need for organizations that see this misalignment and see the need for more money to flow to the smallholder farmers to set the right incentives for that to happen. So whether that is through impact-linked finance, for example, by incentivizing the asset manager that if he gets a certain percentage of his money to smallholder farmers, he will be paid an extra premium, for example, right? Or by also incentivizing some of the middlemen, so the agriculture farmers, to look at which smallholder farmers are they getting their inputs from, right? So like to work with the value chain on some of these questions, that's really crucial. And I think that's a big task that lies ahead of us still, if we want to make sure that this transition is really fair and inclusive.
Thank you, Regina. Maybe Marie-Aimée, if you want to react, but also maybe we could think about how to reach scale, and because there are many, many pilots going on. I mean, lots has been done on that part, but what we need now is replicability. We need scalability, and we need a concrete scalability. I mean, not only scalability, but scale, actual scale. So how maybe you could link these two topics? I'm sure you have ideas on that.
Yeah, well, that's really what is at the core of our impact-based finance approach, which is to look at multiplying impact as a source of additional value and potentially additional revenues or reduced risks, increased resilience, so as to make projects more profitable and therefore more bankable. Because there is no way we can scale up investments that cannot repay the investments that have been made initially, one way or another. So when designing the projects, and I very much echo what Jyoti said, trying to break the silos and make sure that any project, any dollar that is invested is trying to aim as many impacts as possible and benefiting as much as possible from additional revenues combining solutions. And then also trying to innovate and see how we can monetize impact. So we all know about carbon credits, of course, which is a way to monetize the positive impact that regenerative agriculture or tree planting or a mangrove or other wetlands are providing by sequestering carbon, which some investors are ready to pay for in order to compensate for their remaining residual carbon footprint when they're in a net zero trajectory. Well, how can we do that maybe for other ecosystem services that are provided by nature and in particular regenerative agriculture? So biodiversity credits is something we're working on, which by bringing additional revenues that will be generated by the smallholder farmers will enable them to benefit from more access to finance and more potential to scale up their business, for example.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Marianne. Jyoti, maybe because you are in this attempt to go out of silos, and but in the same time, searching for positive impact on one dimension is probably not enough. We need to think of a really holistic approach that takes both into account both the positive impacts, but also the negative externalities or risks that investment can bring. How do you approach this in this regenerative?
Well, I'm going to assume the question ended there. So the interesting thing is that we have got a challenge at the soft green infrastructure end of things. That's what I call this sort of landscape-based, nature-based solutions. I call it soft green infrastructure because we're very used to investing in gray or hard infrastructure, but the soft green stuff, we don't really know how to do it as yet. So about 2 months ago, I held a meeting for some financial institutions and invited them to London to say, can we talk about what it would look like if we were to invest in soft green infrastructure? And we're not interested in doing yet more pilot things because there are loads and loads of pilots around the world and they're not translating into scalable action. So I was simply saying, we're interested at the £1 billion level, you know, and higher. Now, what is it that's going to get you interested? And we went through a few examples. Some of them are North Star examples. So we're looking at examples in Wales, in Scotland, in the east of England. We've just been invited into also exploring transition labs in Kenya and in India. So there are some real examples of actions that can happen on the ground. At the end of the meeting, two of the institutions came to me and said, you just are talking about £1 billion. Is that it? Well, you know what? We could probably do that between ourselves because these seem like interesting projects. Now, I wanted to know, why would they do it? What's in it for them? And these are two large financial institutions. One said, we're a UK-based pension fund. We want to be seen to be using our funds for social impact in the UK, because that makes a lot of sense for our fund. But by the way, we want to make sure we're making money, okay? So they were very clear about it. They said, we want to make sure it's looking good, but it has to make money. The other side was a large financial institution an international financial institution, but based in Europe, and therefore much more switched on to EU taxonomy and what's happening with TCFD, TNFD reporting. And they said, you know what, we're not that fussed about the financial return because we know we're going to have to learn how to do this stuff. We want to know, will we get the carbon? Will we get the biodiversity credits that we're looking for? Because that's the new game in town and that's what our interest is in. So right now we have a learning process on the ground, because we need to know if we did have, say, 1,500 farmers all carrying out actions that were aligned together, will it actually transform the landscape? But on the finance side, we are having to learn how to aggregate as well. And we're having to learn that different financial institutions will have different interests, different motivations, different time horizons, and all of these have to be aggregated too. So the aggregation problem exists on both sides of the bridge.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe a question for Regina, because probably you were rightfully mentioning, Jyoti, that the need for a return is still there. Probably that we have lost a very huge opportunity when free money was a reality, which is not the case anymore. So we had the opportunity to transform these assets valuations that are levitating into positive, concrete, useful uses. But unfortunately, it was only partly the case. So how can blended finance be a solution for that? And what are the most promising players in that space? Is it foundations? Is it governments? Is it development institutions? What is your take on that, Regina?
Thanks. So foundations have a role to play. So do development agencies and development banks. But each have different preferences themselves, right, for the type of initiatives that they get involved. What we always argue would be nicer is if these different organizations at least pool their money together so that not each of them also has a different agenda. But if they together put their money, which at least is all provided on concessional terms, so non-market terms, then at least you have a big enough risk buffer for the commercial investors to come on. What we've seen, though, is that a lot of times it's still very fragmented. So like, let's say the development agency of the German government only does this type of deal, and then the Norwegian government only does this type of stuff, right? So like they all think in their own little boxes and their institutions. And the real transition that we need to see is that these providers of the soft money, the grants and the concessional loans and the first source equity, they cooperate themselves so that they together can unlock the big fish, right? Like the institutional investors. And so that's what you see with some of these blended funds, like the Agri3 fund or the Inter-Resilience Investment Fund, is that you see a number of the development agencies, DFIs and foundations come into the same structure and thereby have a big enough volume to attract the senior investors. So I would say development agencies have historically looked at the agricultural sector as a key thing. And I think with the gender equality becoming more mainstream, that's just becoming even more prominent because there is a lot of smallholder farmers that are women and a lot of, you know, women in the agricultural value chains. So I think it is, like, you can bank on them, but we have to make sure that they collaborate amongst themselves so that we don't have to knock on each door individually and accommodate all their different wishes to get the private money unlocked.
And maybe I would add on this that not only are they collaborating among themselves and the close club deals of DFIs, but systematically crowding local lenders or international banks that need this experience to increase their participation to those markets. And the partial guarantees are the best way to do that, as you pointed out earlier.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we have a question for you from the audience, Marie-Aimé. And maybe after that, we will propose a conclusion word for that webinar. How does Société Générale measure impact across multi-parties international projects?
Very good question. So at SocGen, we've been focusing on impact measurement quite some time ago, since we designed our own positive impact finance framework in 2011, so more than 10 years ago, before the SDGs were even a thing, which is based on the principle that we can only call a project positive impact if we have properly identified and mitigated negative impacts, and we're able to identify and monitor at least one positive impact on at least one of the three pillars of sustainable development, people, planet, and prosperity. So with this in mind, and this is something that we have then further on developed through collaborative initiative with the UNEP-FI, we have some internal tools to screen transactions very early on in the origination to identify whether or not they could be qualified as positive impact, and if not, to give some incentive to the front office who are originating those transactions to add or advise clients to change the project so they have a positive impact. So then in terms of the measurement themselves, It's always down to negotiation with our customers, and whether they are clients, you know, corporate clients, or project sponsors. And we're trying increasingly to select those who are ready to put the resources to make sure that the actual impact, not just the output of the project, will be monitored. And sometimes it means, you know, paying extra costs to get this data collected and monitor it over time.
I was attending to a Paris Peace Forum conference where on biodiversity, and clearly data is one of the hot topic for every environmental and social issue that we face. Maybe before we close, and I will ask you three to share maybe a few words of conclusion. You can subscribe to our newsletter on ksapa.org, ksapa.org. Next webinar will be on how to leverage digital solutions, that's that time, to foster agricultural transition for smallholders, in particular at scale. It will be on Valentine's Day, so it's easy to remember. So please, Marie-Aimée, if you want to share a word of conclusion, and then Jyoti and Regina.
Well, just in a few words, I would say what's absolutely necessary in this sector in particular, but for sustainable development overall, is partnerships. So making sure that we work with the people who are best suited to collaborate and have impact on the ground. And also, second thing I would pick, we talked already a lot about aggregation. So in addition to aggregation, standardization, because we're really running out of time. So we have to urge ourselves into a faster and simpler credit processes and documentation processes as well, so that deals are closed faster.
Super. And I'm not going to disagree with Marie-Aimée, so I'm going to say yes to her points. And I'm going to add in the fact that when we put a transition lab together, we seek the people who we call the disconnected allies. They're disconnected from each other. They don't realize they are actually on the same side and would like to see the same outcomes. And if we want to see a regenerative economy being constructed, these disconnected allies need to be brought together so we can collaborate together and bring the kind of actions that we want to see at scale.
Thank you, Jyoti. Very positive outlook. Regina?
I would agree with Marie-Aimée's point on standardization. In the end, a lot of times these transactions that feature blending instruments, they are very time intensive and complex and take forever to launch. And what we need these transactions to be is boring, standard, and fast, right? And you only get to boring if you have a template that you can replicate and that doesn't have 1,000 bells and whistles. So I would totally agree with Marie-Aimée that that's the way to go. And that's what we at Convergence support as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this very fascinating shares that you brought to us. So it was a pleasure. Next webinar, 14th of February, on digital solutions and transition of agricultural supply chains. Thanks to Regina, Marie-Aimée, and Jyoti for their contribution. And please follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, or newsletter, sapa.org. And see you very soon. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.